The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
Larry McMurtry was born in Wichita Falls, Texas, and he was raised in Archer City, Texas, where he grew up. He was an honor student, a writer, and an athlete at Archer City High School. After graduating from high school, he went on to earn his Bachelor in English degree from North Texas State University, and then his Master's degree from Rice. He was a professor all through the 60s and the beginnings of the 70s at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth, Texas, then at Rice, and then he went on from Texas to George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, and American University in Washington, D.C., where he taught creative writing and English. He's been the winner of numerous fellowships and awards since 1961, when he published his first book, Horsemen Pass By, which then was adapted and became the film HUD. And his career has been an absolutely fabulous one. He is a unique talent. He is a book collector, a bookseller, a voracious reader of great depth and breadth, who has this fabulous memory and recall for not only what he read, but when he read it and where he was when he read it. I mean, it's really incredible. And of course, he is a prolific writer, novelist, essayist, book reviewer, and screenwriter. And so it really is my great pleasure to bring onto the stage, I don't know if they're listening in the green room, I might have to go back and get them, and bring onto the stage William Devereaux and Larry McMurtry.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to sit here today with Larry McMurtry, a writer of wide range and a writer whose work and legacy rests on a prodigious, really prodigious, output of books, essays, screenplays, and more, and a writer who, in my view, has perfect pitch for the historical American West. Thank you all. Thank you very much to Aloud and LAPL, and thank you to you all for coming, and thank you, Larry, for your work. In keeping with the usual protocol for an event such as this, the two of us will chat for 35 or 40 minutes or thereabouts, and then we'll turn things over to you all in the audience for questions and comments. Not surprisingly, I'd like to begin with the West, where so much of your work begins. There's much to praise in the historical accuracy of your work. Could you tell us a little bit, if you will, about where your sense of the West comes from? In other words, can you draw any distinctions between your book knowledge of the West as a reader, a lifelong reader, and your experiential knowledge of the West as a Westerner?
I'm not sure. I mean, they seem part of one experience to me. I grew up in the West. I've traveled all over the West, casually, not very purposely, usually to do gigs like this, or so. And I read most of the good books about the West. There aren't that many. And there aren't that many that were produced by the West that I think all that much of. And since I wasn't the West was the background of my life. I lived in it, and I still do. So I don't think of it as a research subject. What I didn't know much about was European history. And for the last 10, 15 years, I've been reading I'm much more interested in Europe as it built up toward the First World War than I am in the American West. The American West has been the ground of my life. I'm not interested in it in an intellectual way. I respond to it. I respond to its landscape still. But I want to read about the things I don't know anything about. I want to know how we got from apparent calm and order in the 1870s and 1880s to the catastrophe that occurred in 1914. And it's very complex, and there are thousands of books on it, and hundreds of biographies of important, the many people, who the many leaders, Russian, French, German, and English, that caught, you know, that were in action, and somehow or other, civilization that seemed to be reaching its highest point with Freud and Virginia Woolf and Mahler and Proust and many, many great thinkers, writers, musicians, painters, Picasso, Cézanne. How did we get from that to Ypres, the Battle of Passchendaele, the Battle of the Somme, where as many people were killed on one side as killed in the whole Vietnam War on our side in one day? How did Europe shatter what appeared to be an advanced and stable civilization? And like Virginia Woolf made a famous remark that on or about December 1910, human nature changed. Well, that's provocative, but my interest has been, and what interests me, I've thought sometimes I might want to write a book about the greatest stories, three or four of the greatest stories of the 20th century. And were I to do that, the greatest stories, in my opinion, would be Nicholas and Alexandra, would be Hitler, would be Gandhi, and I'm not sure what's number four, but I think I could find a number four that would be comparable. And that involves huge reading. I mean, I have probably 1,000 books on World War I, and I've pretty well read them without having reached any conclusion. It was so complicated, and, you know, these great dynasties, the Romanovs, the Hohenzollerns, the Habsburgs, the Ottomans, all centuries-old dynasties gone in 3 years. Very much something to ponder. So to me, the West is a job that occasionally comes my way.
Well, I'm interested in this notion about you saying you're not intellectually interested in the West, because certainly your books offer a great deal of intellectual content and ferment about the West. And in that particular sense, to my scholarly eyes, your books and the visual vehicles or films that they're often made into look right. But they also sound right. It's clear to me that you've not only read about the West, you've listened to it. Your books have sounds, as all landscapes and humans make, and they're spot on. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Have you ever thought about that and how you've honed your, what I think is perfect acoustical pitch for the West?
I don't think I honed it. I think I just have it. It's like having perfect pitch. You don't hone it. You just have it, or you don't.
How about the notion of the colloquialisms and language from the 19th century that I think are largely absent today, but you've got in your books?
Well, my grandparents came to Texas in the 1870s, and they produced 12 children, and I grew up in an oral culture before there was radio, and people told stories. And, you know, I say, and I'm just about to publish a book called Books, a memoir about my life with books as a writer, reader, and bookseller. And I start off by remembering that that on good nights at our ranch house, which is now my son's, the old folks and whoever was around, cowboys, cooks, my grandparents, my parents, would sit on the porch and tell stories. And Lonesome Dove, for a long time, was as far back as I would go time-wise in Western history, because I felt that was within the reach of my family memory. You know, my family lived that. Two of my uncles were old enough to go on trail drives. not the great trail drives from Texas to Montana, the sort of Silver Age trail drives, maybe to Oklahoma City or wherever they had a deal for the cattle. So that was not a reach for me linguistically. It was the language my people spoke, and I never thought of it as historical. And I was careful for a long, long time of going back beyond the 1870s or even the 1880s, because I knew, and I didn't research it, I didn't think about it, I just wrote it. I have an ear for dialogue, the dialogue comes very easily to me. And so that was not a problem. I did, after I don't know how many years, 40 years of reading about the West, I did go backward. I never meant to go backward beyond 1870-75. The trail drive started right after the Civil War, and the range cattle industry sort of surged like the oil industry did. All of a sudden there was this new thing, the range cattle industry. But in the course of reviewing, I began to read the Lewis and Clark journals for a piece I did about them for the New York Review of Books. And Lewis and Clark were so extraordinary. That expedition was so extraordinary. You take all those men and you go nearly 8,000 miles and you lose only one man, unfortunately, Corporal Floyd, who danced all night with the Yato girls in the region of Sioux City and ruptured his appendix and died. Otherwise, they didn't lose a single man. And they went all the way across the continent and back, and without losing anyone except Sergeant Floyd. And I believe they only killed one Indian. They were very conscious of needing to keep good relations with the Indian, and they got in a little squabble. They might have killed two. Well, we don't ever know. We don't know if the second Indian died or not. But with the Blackfeet, they had some scuffles. And in one of these scuffles, a Blackfoot warrior ran off with Captain Lewis's rifle. Somebody's rifle, and Captain Lewis pursued him and then realized that his gun was empty. He killed that one Indian and shot another one, and the other Indian fled. We don't know if he died or if he didn't. But to lose one man and to kill only one native in a Tetchy expedition that covered the whole continent and back is very remarkable. So I got interested in, what I really got interested in was the Missouri River, which was the great 405 freeway of the 19th century. It's the freeway that carried...
God forbid.
Well, it was the Great River, but there are more than 450 steamboats sunk in it. It was just as treacherous as the 405 because it concealed a lot of buried trees and logs and stuff like that, and they often ripped the bottom out of these 450 boats. But I got interested in the Missouri, and I wanted very much to make a trip up it or down it and write about Lewis and Clark from that perspective. Can't be done. The Missouri River is now chopped up. It's a commercial river. 1,000 miles of it are completely unusable. It's reservoirs and dikes and permissions, although I will say that William Least Heat Moon, he of the Blue Highways, managed to go up the Missouri River on a boat. But it was hard, and he had to get endless permits, and of course he had to portage around some of it, and you can't just start at where the Lewis and Clark started at St. Charles, Missouri, and flow up the river. You can come down it if you start at the other end for about 150 miles, and then you get into the reservoirs, and you get into the docks and documentation and stuff like that. So I had to give up on traveling the Missouri River, but I got fascinated with it, particularly with the opening of the Missouri River to steam travel, which occurred in 1832. And the artist George Catlin was on the first boat, the Rocky Mount, that went up the Missouri River in 1932. I got interested in it and just kept reading about it, and I got interested in how quickly the noble European families flowed into it, mostly to hunt. In the case of Prince Maximilian, not just to hunt, but to he was an ethnologist essentially, and he had this great artist called Carl Bodmer who traveled with him and produced, I think, the best Western art there is. Got interested in it and read, and finally I did write a tetralogy, unknown to man really, called the Berrybender Narratives, and there are four books.
Fictional?
Yeah.
Fictional.
Uh-huh. Yeah, published within 10 years. You see, they're unknown not only to man but to Bill. They are pretty good. They're pretty good books, and Simon and Schuster is bored with me by this time, and they just kind of shuffle those books out and right into the hold, and nobody knows them. But I created a great English, a reverse Daisy Miller, in which a great English family, the Berrybenders, Lord Berrybenders, his numerous children, his mistresses, his tutors. Cellist, artist, gunsmiths, carriage makers, start up the Missouri River, 1832, on the first boat for a grand hunting trip. And they make a circle that starts with the first boat going up. They're up at Fort Union for a while. They get involved with the mountain men. They come down the Yellowstone to the Green River. They get across eventually to the Rio Grande, and they make this circle just in time for Lord Berrybender to be involved in the Alamo. So it's 4 years, 1832, 1836. They were dramatic years for the opening of the West. The reason, and the four artists had the great good fortune to get there. Catlin, Bodmer, Alfred Jacob Miller, essentially, saw the Indians as they were and the mountain men as they were. And then in 1836 and following, smallpox began to decimate the river tribes, particularly the Mandans and the Arikaras that had a kind of trading entrepot at the junction of the Missouri. It's up for Pierre, South Dakota, isn't it? In fact, it's the survival of farms interests me. It's still a trading entrepot. It's where the strip mall along the freeway was invented, and just where Lewis and Clark were running into all these French people and all these English people, all trading furs with the Mandans, who were sort of the river keepers. Same thing's happening today. Go to Pierre. You'll find lots of things to trade in. Anyway, I got interested, and I invented various people. In fact, I think the Berrybenders have a total of 138 characters, which is hard to make a film with. 138 actors is a lot of actors. Anyway, I got interested, and I went back beyond my family memory to write the Berrybenders. And who's to say, but, you know, something like that may grab me again. And it came out of those four books came out of my reading of the Lewis and Clark journals, which are finally published more than 200 years after Captain Lewis submitted to President Jefferson. Oddly enough, President Jefferson seemed to kind of have lost interest. He went to great trouble recruiting people to make the Western Crossing. He checked off two or three. He had a French botanist that was kind of a crook and various things. And then somehow it ended up Lewis and Clark. And then years passed and they actually came back. And they had kept meticulous records. Every mile of their travel was measured. Every temperature, every fog, every rainfall was measured. It's one of the most measured expeditions in human history. And yet, I don't know, the president seemed to have just kind of lost interest. So the papers were deposited with the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia, and there was a kind of journalistic edition published, but the first edition, which was very incomplete. They were still finding particles of the Lewis and Clark journals into the 60s, into the 1960s. The last thing they found was about 100 pages in Clark's hand that was that were somehow been in with the possessions of a general in Minnesota. It was discovered in the Minnesota Historical Society. So finally, the University of Nebraska, with tremendous patience and discipline, there's now 13 volumes of the whole thing has finally been published more than 200 years after it happened. And the atlas is there, and the botanical record is there. And that got me interested enough that I wrote The Berry Benders. And I still think it's one of the great unknown classics of American literature. Is, no, not The Berry Benders, the Lewis and Clark journals.
Let me ask you, you mentioned your work as an essayist and a book reviewer. You're a novelist and a screenwriter of fictional people and fictional lives and fictional events. But you're every bit as much an essayist and a clever, tough-minded book reviewer. And for those of you that don't know Larry's book reviews in the New York Review of Books, I highly recommend them to you. Collected book reviews on books generally about the American West. And if there are graduate students in the room, I really recommend those to you for a crystalline model of how to do a book review. You have a special interest in academic books about the West, I think.
The New York Review has a special interest in books and books, academic books about the West, and thinks I'm a reliable student of them.
Well, talk to me about this. Does the fictional side of your writing and this academic and non-fictional book review essayist side of your writing, two halves of the same whole, or very different?
They're not very different. I mean, it's just a job of work. I started reviewing when I was first in Rice, which had been 1954, for the Wichita Falls paper, just in order to get free books. That's why I did most of my early reviewing. You get the books free, and sometimes you get four or five, and you pick one and you review it. I don't solicit reviewing jobs. People solicit me to do reviewing jobs, and if I'm interested and I think I can do it, I do. It's true that with the New York Review that the collection, Sacagawea's Nickname, was one of my most glorious moments in reading these 13 tightly packed volumes. I think I haven't written about this, but I think General Clark was in love with Sacagawea. And I think that Sacagawea had a fondness for William Clark. I don't know that this exactly what happened. She was married to Monsieur Charbonneau, who was the interpreter for the Lewis and Clark expedition when they got over when they got over to the West. And I don't know if her nickname was Janie. There's about 4,500 pages of the Lewis and Clark journals. And Janie is only used once. So finding Janie and figuring out that this was Sacagawea's nickname and this was what William Clark called her was a great treat for me. You know, you wade through 4,500 pages and the name is only used once, and who is Janie? And then you realize if you go to the correspondence, the expedition correspondence, name Janie is used a lot, but in the main narrative, she's only mentioned by that name once. So I made a good title for a book, Sacagawea's Nickname.
You write about, in your book reviews, you often write about, even obliquely, some of the disputes that historians of the American West get into, which we historians still quibble. And then some about distinctions between what's called the Old West and the New West, or the Old Western history and the New Western history. Some of these quibbles between historians are methodological, some are political, and some are meant to be about these temporal boundaries that Larry's talking about, before or after certain periods. You've offered your thoughts from time to time on these quibbles and these internecine debates within academics. What do you make of that set of disputes or that ferment these days?
Which one?
old Western historians versus new Western historians. The old classic Western stories, let's say Bernard DeVoto and others, and then the new work of the last 20 years.
The revisionists are totally dominant, as far as I'm concerned. They're totally dominant.
Good thing, bad thing?
Well, Patricia Limerick, who is the leader of the revisionist historians in America, and she's in Colorado, she's in Boulder, wrote a turning point book called The Legacy of Conquest. And up to that time, the settlement of the West had been regarded triumphantly as a tremendous triumph of American might over distance and time and difficulty and climate and resistance from the native peoples and blah, blah, blah. And Patricia Limerick and her students and her followers began to argue that the legacy of conquest was not good, that we destroyed the native people, that we wrecked the environment, which was pristine. That's an argument that's complicated. And that, in general, we ought to be ashamed of ourselves for the things we did for the legacy of conquest. And now, a whole school of historians has come out from under the legacy of conquest. And I just reviewed for the New York Review, it'll be out in a little while, a major slashing, totally ultra extreme, out there on the borderland, revisionist history of the Comanche people. The professor wrote it, I can't pronounce his name because he's a Finn. He's from Finland. I think he teaches, I'm not sure where, maybe SMU, or I don't know where he is now. But he argues for a Comanche empire, which was the dominant force in the Southwest for 150 years, or at least 100, from around 1750 till around 1850, when the Comanches began to slide. I think, and there's another historian named Gary Clayton Anderson, whom I've also reviewed, in a book called The Conquest of Texas, damages, it had already been damaged a bit, the reputation of the Texas Rangers, for example, who were aggressively violent on the border against Mexicans and against Indians, too. Anyway, it's clear that the revisionist school, criticizing the settlement of the West as it was traditionally described in textbooks for 75 years, is wrong, and that they have won for the moment. You never win these things forever, but they have won for the moment, and they control the history departments of most of the major universities and the academic, the university presses, and et cetera, et cetera. So the revisionists have chased out the triumphalists. And it's true that the triumphalists were pretty wobbly. They weren't really very good. Bernard DeVoto is a very readable, popular historian. Barbara Tuchman is a very readable, popular historian. And yet, there's much that they ignored, particularly DeVoto. And I don't know. But this controversy is pretty well over. The revisionists academically have won and hold many forts.
Let's talk about a slightly related question related to masculinity in the West. The West has long been a place where American masculinity is tried, tested, and forged, or what have you, and it's often referred to as a canvas upon which various crises of American masculinity work themselves out one way or another. You've contributed some very memorable characters to this genre, Woodrow Call and Augustus McCrae among them. Can you offer some thoughts to us about the issue of masculinity in the West and your portrayals? And in doing so, would you care to weave in your thoughts, some perspective in this regard, on Ennis Del Mar, the character played so memorably by Heath Ledger in Brokeback Mountain?
No.
Fair enough.
I don't have the slightest thing to say about masculinity in the West. There are boys and there are girls. And some girls like girls and some boys like boys. And I don't have anything to say about masculinity in the West. It's just never... something I've turned my thoughts toward.
That's perfectly legitimate. Now, you spoke last night, and perhaps some of you in the audience were there. There was a dinner last night in Larry's honor for this award from the LAPL. You spoke last night about books, and you offered in the conclusion of the evening an eloquent and moving requiem for books, and told a story to all of us that were there about yourself as a boy when you were given a cache of 19 books by a cousin and how that moment changed your life. Can you relate that to this audience here today, and also tell us a little bit about those 19 books and what you remember about them or particular titles?
I can remember some of the titles. As I said, I didn't know how to read, and yet I miraculously learned to read. My cousin left the books in my room, and as he walked out, I picked a book up and read it. And it was a book called Sergeant Silk, Prairie Scout. The 19 books were just the standard boys' books of the 30s. There was a Papillote series, Papillote and the Stuttering Parrot, Papillote and the Whispering Cave, blah, 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 blah. And it was on and on like that. I think in my first writing about, and it is true that that gift changed my life and made my life the splendid life it has been. But I think I romanticized it a little bit because I think I said that Don Quixote was in the box, and I now think that was Gilding the Lily. I don't believe it was. I believe I did read some abridged or child-reduced version of Don Quixote at a pretty early age, say within 3 or 4 years of being given those books. And I recognized it as being of a different order of things from Papillote and the Stuttering Parrot. Very clearly, the Don and Sancho are great archetypes that resonate entirely through Western literature, and which I was mean in the broad sense, and certainly are the precursors of Gus and Carl. They're the archetypes. The visionary and the practical man, the prairie the practical fellow and the mad Don. And who do you follow? And it's one of the most poignant passages in all literature is the end of Don Quixote, part two. There were two parts. When these people have been, these two have been together, much like Gus and Carl, for so long that they want to stay together. And the old Don is dying, and Sancho is trying to keep him alive, and he said, yeah, you were right, I was wrong. You know, those windmills were really giants. Those sheep were really evil Saracens, blah, 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 blah. He tried to take on his partner's position, and the Don said, no, I was crazy. Anyway, it's a great book, and it's a great archetype, and a great way to bring yourself to fiction. And sometime between, I'd say, age 6 and age 10, I read some version of it.
In talking about books last night and bemoaning the loss of what we might call the book world or the book itself, it made me wonder about your thoughts of this lost world of books, or the fading world of books, or as you put it last night, that it's already lost. Do you think that'll change the role of great libraries like this? In other words, do you think they'll become more museum-like repositories than democratizing places where books are put to use constantly?
I fear for libraries. I fear for them a lot. They've done centuries of good, but I think they're very threatened. The computers are marching into the libraries, and the books are being sent away. And that's happening in hundreds of libraries, not just happening in one or two. And what I've seen happen in my life is, and Steve Jobs said the other day, or was quoted as saying, that it didn't matter what kind of ebook Amazon Con comes up with, people don't read anymore. If he had just qualified it a little bit and said the majority of people don't read anymore, he would have been right. The great majority of people don't read anymore. And what in my childhood was a democratic pleasure, open to anyone who could get a library card, I couldn't because there was no library. The reason I'm making this speech is because there is now a library and I want to fund it. But it went from being a democratic, demotic pleasure to being a Mandarin pleasure, which is what it is now. Mandarins, us Mandarins read. I just was talking with a librarian last night, and I said, I think that children adore to read. I just gave all the children's books that we have in my 325,000 volume bookshop, it's not that many, maybe it might have been 800, to a play school next door. And I know that children delight in reading just as much today as they ever did. However, there is a point at which technology seduces them, and that away from the word toward music, or toward movies, or toward iPods, or toward a more and more broken narrative. And that is age 10, age 11. They want to have the gadgets their friends have. They want to listen to download music. They want to download movies. They want to do all that. And at that, and I have a very good grandson who's just about to turn 18, and he was a big, big reader. He had Curtis, and he was somewhat like me. He was meticulous about his reading. He had almost a couple thousand books. And yet, I don't think that Curtis is reading now. I think that he's entirely, he is a musician, and he's in a good town in Austin, a good town for a young musician. He has a really good teen rock scene and stuff. And I think that, I don't know if Curtis will come back to books. Once in a while, maybe, I'm not sure. But I think that point in which you're not reading books about Spot, you're not reading Flopsy, Mopsy, and Cottontail, you reach a point where you have to cross into at least the young adult level. And then I think a lot of them just lose it there and go to music and movies. I don't know. It's a pessimist, I mean, but you can say, it's very sad to me that the bookshops of L.A. are gone. There are more than 115 when I first came here in the 60s, just between, say, Long Beach and Van Nuys. But even worse than the loss of the bookshops, you know, trades die. My father spent his life watching ranching die. I spent my life watching bookselling die. And they do die. But I don't, I think that what would be more catastrophic than the loss of 50 or 60 booksellers in Los Angeles is the loss of reading itself, which is one of the stablest and richest pleasures of life, and cheapest. I don't know. It worries me, and I've addressed this a little bit in my forthcoming book.
I'm going to ask our guests one more question and then turn things over to you all, and there'll be a microphone making its way around. So if you've got a question, you might formulate it so we can turn to you quickly. I suspect you get tired of answering this question, but I'm curious enough about it that I'd like to ask you. Are there in the whole litany of characters you've created some of them that still walk with you and that you still think about a lot, and who and why?
Emma. Emma still walks with me from Terms of Endearment. Some of you know the wonderful passage that Diane Keaton read last night. Of my characters, let me see, Harmony, the showgirl who loses her show to her own daughter, or her part in her show to her own daughter. Harmony, Emma, and Maggie from Loop Group. A role I'd love to see Miss Keaton play. And they're all women. Maggie's a working girl of Hollywood. She works in production. And Harmony's a showgirl, just about to be over the hill. And Emma is a wife and mother, an academic. Those are the three that linger in my thoughts. I don't think much about the guys. In fact, I don't think at all about the guys.
Would you join me in thanking Larry for this first part of our conversation?
Thank you.
I don't think there's such a thing as a wrong question. I think there is such a thing as a long question. So out of deference to time and your fellow audience members, please try to keep your questions short.
Yeah.
We might just wait for the mic so we can get it on the tape. Thanks.
This isn't a question, it's an observation. I spent the last weekend on the UCLA campus at the book fair. I think they said there were 150,000 people there each day. That's a lot of readers.
Where's that?
At the book fair on the UCLA campus, the Los Angeles Times book fair. Enormous crowds of readers. It's really heartening. I don't really disagree with what you say, but at least there are readers that do remain.
I know. It's an old thing, reading, and there will be flare-ups, and there will be people defend it, and all that is fine. But it doesn't save the booksellers. Somebody there. Yeah, you in yellow.
I've greatly enjoyed two of your books, Dwayne's Depressed and Walter Benjamin. Mm-hmm. And I think they're very intimate books. I wonder if you could share a little bit how that was for you to write them.
Oh, it all started part of the process, you know. I like to do sequels and more sequels and tetralogies. I've written four tetralogies, which is rather unusual for any writer. The Last Picture Show tetralogy, Lonesome Dove tetralogy, Terms of Endear tetralogy, and Barry Bender tetralogy. I like to revisit my characters at different stages of life and see how they are when they're young and when they're not young and blah, 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 blah. So it just seems natural to me to do that. And I don't know if I've answered the question or not.
Was it autobiographical in any way?
Only in that the ground, the setting is autobiographical. I live in the West, and so the books are about the West, but are set in the West, but they're not autobiographical in terms of things that happened to me.
Mm-hmm. When I go to art museums and see portraits, I always wonder whether they're painted of a specific person or they're something that's created in the mind of the artist. With your characters, are they often of people that you knew or some variation, or are they sort of ground out of your imagination?
They're just made up. They're not related to people I know. I mean, you can sometimes take an eccentric person. I did it, I think, in my first novel of The Village, sort of night watchman, and you can use someone based on him once. But essentially, they're all made up. And I don't hardly ever use a real model or a real incident.
In my reading of your work, I have noticed this about your characters, and you just mentioned something there about the women that you remember or keep in mind. I've noticed that they have a great individuality and is strong. I mean, even if the bad ones and the good ones, you know, they're such strong characters. Is this from your experience or from your reading or, you know?
Well, Texas is a pretty strong place. I was fortunate to grow up in a strong landscape with very strong grandparents and parents and really, truly pioneers. I'm one of the last writers who, my paternal grandparents came to an absolutely empty frontier in West Texas, absolutely empty, no county, no town, no stores, no nothing, and they survived, and they didn't lose a single child. So that strength of personality was all around me when I was growing up. It just seems it's easy.
I just have to ask, did your household read fiction?
My household, I've never had a household. You mean my grandparents'
sure.
household?
Yeah.
I say in my recent book, my book is about to be coming, I can't remember ever being told a story, ever. Nobody told me a story. I had the real world of the ranch at the end of the Depression to work with. My biggest problem was poultry. We produced everything we ate, vegetable and mineral. We had chickens, gamecocks, peacocks, turkeys, occasional goose, guinea hens, da da da. I was this high. Poultry doesn't seem like a threat to most people, but if you're that high and you have to go through an area that boils with poultry all just to get to the barn, it has a different effect. So I grew up with very strong people, but they weren't readers. Now, some of my older cousins who knew my grandmother when she was younger said she was a very curious person who subscribed to all the magazines and blah, blah, blah. There was not one magazine or one book in the ranch house where I grew up that I can recall. I don't know where they went if she subscribed to all those magazines. But of course, she was 50 years older by that time, and her interest had changed, I guess. Had a couple here.
You have the ability to make me laugh out loud when I'm reading your books. Does that only come out in your writing, or?
Well, I once in a while can write funny. It's not easy. It's a curious thing that all comedians, if you study the lives of comedians, you won't find happy people. Comedy comes out of pain. And one or two books that I've written that are mostly funny, like All My Friends Are Going to Be Strangers, are very hard to write. Whereas the tragedies are very easy to write. It's easy to write tragedy. It's hard to write comedy. Hard to produce comedy.
It's funny you mentioned All My Friends Are Going to Be Strangers. That's exactly where I was going. I'm a little confused. You said sitting on the porch, you were told stories where everyone talked.
Oh, I listened to the adult stories. They weren't telling me stories.
Were they actual sort of anecdotes that had a beginning, middle, and end? So did you, I'm thinking of the story
Uncle Laredo.
When they ask for the, when the Native Americans ask the ranchers for the, I think it's a steer that they then go and hunt. And is that like, for that, as an example of that, was that like an actual anecdote you heard that you lifted lock, stock,
and barrel? No, it's a famous thing. I don't know whether it happened or not. John Graves, the Texas writer John Graves, written a limited edition book called The Last Running. And from his reading somehow, or from his knowledge of Charles Goodnight, he tells this story of the Indians who were over at Fort Sill coming over and begging Goodnight for a buffalo, and he sends them off, and they won't go, and they sort of sulk around, and he finally gives them a buffalo. And he thinks they want to eat it, but in fact, they just want to kill it in the old way, by running it and killing it with lances. I kind of don't believe that story. It doesn't ring true to me on several levels. I don't think he would have given them one. He had plenty of buffalo. They could have got one if they really were serious about running a buffalo, and it just doesn't feel right. I may have mentioned it in All My Friends, but I don't know. I don't endorse it. It doesn't sound right. Something sounds wrong, but that's just instinct.
Well, are there anecdotes from the front porch that are used lock, stock, and barrel in the novels?
No.
You were talking earlier about your interest in European history and the early 20th century, things that led up to the First World War. And I'm wondering if, in your exploration of that, there's anything in terms of parallels that can be related to the present, or if that has anything to do with your interest in it.
No, I don't think so. I think I'm interested in the Great War for the Great War's sake, and I don't think it has anything to do with my politics today.
In your writing, you've got the Lewis and Clark era project to hold a bracket chronologically in the early 19th century. Remind us how far forward you've gone.
Gosh, 41 books forward. I can't
remember. But 1960?
Actually, I'm writing a book right now about a rhinoceros, strangely enough. And it's set in contemporary George Bush times. But, of course, it may turn out to be junk, and I may never show it to anybody, and it may be just it may be a trifle that doesn't cohere.
Hi, I was interested in hearing a little about your experiences with adaptation of either your own work or somebody else's work for Phil.
If I am too far past the novel, I am not a good adapter. Sometimes my partner, Diana Osana, can adjust that and she can adapt it. The idea of why to adapt one's own work is to go straight from the last page of the novel into the first page of the screenplay. That depends upon studio, politics, whether you've got a job, whether they want it, da-da-da-da-da. That's the ideal before any of your interests has time to fall off. If I am showing a book that I've written 10 or 12 years ago, I'm not the ideal adapter, unless Diana can pick it up, which she often can't, usually can. But I don't really distinguish, because by the time I would adapt one of my own books, if it had been published 10 years ago, it would be like somebody else's book. It wouldn't be familiar to me. Here's the guy with the mic.
You write with very great regularity. Do you allow your writing to be driven by a character coming to mind, or do you try to map out a novel?
I don't map out. I almost always have an ending in mind. I almost always work toward an ending, a final scene in which something crucial has happened to some people, and this is where it's brought them. I don't know what brought them there. That's what I find out when I write the novel. But I'm not, it's a mixed process. Sometimes I do it one way, sometimes I do it another. But almost always have an ending in mind first.
From listening to you this afternoon, it seems like place is very important to you. Do you have any interest in going and living in Europe? Having recently come back from Ireland, place seems to have a lot to say to somebody of your...
Place does have a lot to say, but it doesn't say it quickly. I feel I need to live in a place about 10 years before I write about it. And even then I may not write about it. Until, for example, you create a character that's walking down Pennsylvania Avenue, Hollywood Boulevard, the Loop in Chicago, you know, someplace, until a character just shows up that's there. This is the environment that he or she lives in. That is, until I know a place well enough to spontaneously choose it, I don't know it well enough to write about it. And I have written novels that weren't set in the West. I've written, I don't know, Cadillac Jack is mostly... not. I've written Hollywood novels, two or three Hollywood novels. It's not a precise process, but usually 10 years is a good length of time to spend with something, and then you begin to naturally think of the characters in that setting. But I couldn't just visit someplace and write a novel about it. Somebody way back.
I took a course in college a long time ago, which was called Literature of the American West, and it started with Cooper and ended with Nathaniel West's Day of the Locust, which was like, I graduated in 1961, so that's where we were. Which of your books would you add to this list or update if you had to teach a course like that in college today, of your books?
Well, you tend to think of your favorite book as being the book you enjoyed writing the most, not necessarily the best at all. But I enjoyed The Desert Rose because I'd been in a slump for 9 years. I didn't like my writing. I had written quite a few books, and I didn't see much point in going on with it. I didn't think I had any future with it. And I was offered a movie job to Las Vegas to write about a showgirl, and didn't do the movie job, didn't spend but one day in Las Vegas, but I did meet a couple of showgirls, and they told me about a legendary showgirl named Felicity, whom I, in fact, I never met, although she exists. But she drifted off, or she was on a junket, or she wasn't there. So I made her up, and I called her Harmony. And she's my favorite, one of my favorite characters. Yeah?
We have about time for two more questions.
What has been the reaction of your Texas neighbors to the portraits you've painted and presented to the rest of us concerning them?
Whether I have Texas neighbors is a hard question. I have a few people in my family, my hometown, the young ladies who run my bookshop. But I'm not much. I go to my hometown once a month, maybe, or something like that. Otherwise, I live in Tucson. They have no reaction to my fiction at all, and neither does anyone in Texas much. Just zero, zip. I just don't have much.
We're going to have to close here with the final question.
Hello. Your bookstore, I think, is probably one of the largest in the country. I think it's huge, and you're a voracious reader. So for the audience, would you mind telling us a list of, say, 10 of your favorite novels from other writers?
No.
No.
We have time for one more question.
Wait a minute. I don't want to turn the lady off. I just don't remember. I don't read fiction. I haven't read fiction for a long time because I reviewed too much of it in my youth. And certainly I could tell you 10 novels that I like. I like Proust, I like Tolstoy, I like George Eliot, and a lot of them. But I don't pretend to keep up with even my own generation of fiction writers. And so I don't have any response to that. Yeah.
Justin, should we squeeze one more in?
Sure.
Okay.
Well, you mentioned your grandson earlier and him maybe leaving reading. What are you doing as a grandparent to guilt him back into reading?
I didn't hear it, unfortunately.
What are you doing to bring your grandson back to books?
Nothing. Nothing. He'll either make it or come back or he won't. He's a very strong character. You don't do things with Curtis. He's one of the most self-possessed human I've ever known. And I say, "Are you reading?" And he usually just ignores the question. Or he might say, "I got too many bands to play in," or something like that. I would not predict what that boy does. But it'll be interesting.
Well, I think you'll agree with me. It's a splendid way to spend a lunch hour. Thanks to Aloud, thanks to you all, and thanks to Larry McMurtry.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.